Show.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It's past the hour here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful West by God, Virginia. I'm Bob. Thursday. And after what a wonderful conversation we had last night with Bryce Phillips down on the Gulf. Heroic efforts running community radio in the face of any number of obstructions and obstacles. And what a great show that was just in the last hour. Mind-boggling stuff. Scientology. Oy. Oh, go figure. Makes my head hurt just thinking about it. But then again, you know, that's the one thing, you know, we there are people out there saying, wow, you know, it's an illegitimate religion, Scientology. Show me a legitimate religion. I mean, you know, believe what you wish to believe. You're certainly, it's a lovely little right we have in the First Amendment. But point me to any religion on the planet that doesn't ask you to believe something ridiculous. I mean, Scientology comes from Xenu or somewhere. The Mormons come from some other planet, too. What the hell's the difference between either one of those and the goobers from Heaven's Gate who off themselves in their brand new Nikes and tracksuits in hopes of joining a starship hiding behind a comet's tail? You know, I mean, come on. And you know, the mainstream American stuff where, you know, oh, I ate the cookie. It's meat in my tummy now. Mm. You know, go live on those things and see if they turn into protein, okay? See if you can survive on the host. Because you can't. But that's the... Just... It's all grounded in P.T. Barnum, isn't it? There's a sucker born every minute. People, and the sad thing is, it's a matter of preying upon people who are searching for meaning, unable to find it for themselves, and somebody comes along, oh, I got the meaning over here. It only costs $1.75. Oh, that's for the first minute. What's the difference? What's the difference between an organized religion, be it Scientology or Southern Baptists or Mormons or any of it? What's the difference between that and the phone sex? It's gratification, and you pay for it. Oh, well. That's the bone, huh? But I gotta admit, I may have screwed up. I had a guest lined up for this evening, and when I called to hook up with the guest, I said, you know, show's on from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and I make certain assumptions that you know, everybody just sort of catches that. But my guest is on the West Coast and may be expecting me to call 3 hours from now. Darn it. Because I was really looking forward to this conversation. We were going to have, and may yet. Never give up. Never say never. Chris O'Brien is a beer activist. And he has a great new book called Fermenting Revolution. There's a link to it up on the show post now. Fermenting Revolution, How to Drink Beer and Save the World. That's a book I want to read. Because I'm a beer guy. You know, I can't tell you the difference between a Puy Fusse and a Chateau Lafite Rothschild 1932 with the overtones of cherry and old baseball glove. But I can damn sure talk some beer. And Chris is a beer activist, as I said. He's also with the Center for a New American Dream, director of the Responsible Purchasing Network. Oh, I like this guy's CV a whole lot. He's been all over the world researching brewing traditions. This guy has my dream job. Go somewhere and drink beer. And see if there's another different kind of beer to drink after that. Yeah, I'd spend all my time researching in Belgium. I really would. With occasional forays into England, Scotland, Germany. Maybe, you know, down into France a couple of times. It traveled to Peru, maybe. Drink some of that that native fermented corn stuff. In Peru, I think it's acá is the Quechua word for it. It's a fermented corn beverage. This is the part where everybody's going to go, ew! You know, it's not like they went down to the store, the Inca, and got an envelope of Fleischmann's yeast and threw it into the liquid corn mash. They did, however, have an ever-ready supply of yeast and lactobacillus with which to get the corn going. It's called saliva. And they would chew the ground corn and put it in a bucket or a bowl, if I understand correctly. Something similar also took place in the Sierra Madre Occidental of Mexico among the Rarámuri people and a beverage called Tesquino, which is also another corn beer. To this day, you can get something in the market stalls of Mexico City and other places called pulque, which is a beer type beverage made from maguey sap. I am told that the Nahuatl word for it was ocli. All around the world, people have sought to make something to change the normal run-of-the-mill day at the end of that day. Often, when it was first discovered, it became associated with religious observance and transcendence and getting in contact with the gods. And you can even hear it today on a hot in this modern era on a hot summer's afternoon after a long, hot, sweaty day of work when you hear that first pfft, and the drinker will take a big swaller and proclaim, God, that's good! 'Cause it is. So I don't know. Boy, I tell you what, that would have been a great conversation, wouldn't it? But I may have screwed up horribly. I hope not. I hope there's just a little hitch or something along the way. But doggone, I apologize. Hopefully we'll square all of that away with any luck at all. In the meantime, certainly no dearth of conversation opportunities abound. Where do you want to start? There's 100 places to start. Shall we start with a giggle? Just catching up with some stuff. A giggle, yeah. Joe Lieberman. When he was running against Ned Lamont and his website crashed, and he said, clearly, this is dirty politics on the part of my opponent. They have deliberately crashed my website. Oops. FBI report came out in the last couple of days. This is the guy who thinks he's competent enough to talk about war around the world and what we need to do to stabilize the Middle East. The Lieberman campaign kind of crashed its own website. Shh. That's really embarrassing. According to the FBI, his 2006 re-election campaign was to blame for the crash of its website the day before the August 8th Democratic primary when Joe Lieberman got his butt handed to him by Ned Lamont and went on because, you know, he just spat in the face of Democratic voters of Connecticut and went on to form Connecticut for Lieberman. I'm not going to call him Lieberman anymore. He's Lieberman. He's a dirty, filthy, rotten little liar. Therefore, Lieberman. I advise you to do the same. Although you are free to not take my advice. The FBI office in New Haven found no evidence whatsoever supporting the Lieberman campaign's allegations that supporters of Ned Lamont were to blame for the website crash. What it turned out was, FBI determined the server that hosted the Joe2006.com website failed because it was overutilized and misconfigured. There was no evidence of an attack. It was just, as is the case with Joe Lieberman's entire political life these days, incompetent. So the investigation's been closed. And we're a couple of days into the news of this coming out. And, of course, Joe Lieberman has yet to apologize. He outright slandered his opponent, accusing his opponent and his campaign of criminal conduct in the form of... They have hacked into my website. No, they didn't, Joe, you filthy little liar. Didn't do anything of the sort. You're just incompetent, buddy. And you can apologize any time you feel like it. You can apologize to Ned Lamont, who is about... 10 million, jillion, billion, quadrillion times a better man than you are. See, when Lieberman's website crashed at the time, a message came up on the screen calling on Ned Lamont to make an unqualified statement denouncing this kind of dirty campaign trick and demand whoever is responsible to cease and desist immediately. Of course, as it turned out, it was a little bit difficult for Ned Lamont to do that because, Joe Lieberman's own people did it. The FBI memo, just for those of you who are web-savvy and design-savvy on this stuff, said that the site crashed because Lieberman officials continually exceeded a configured limit of 100 emails per hour the night before the primary. Quote from the memo, the system administrator misinterpreted the root cause. The system administrator finally declared the server was being attacked and the Lieberman campaign accused the Ned Lamont campaign. The news reported this on August 8, 2006, causing additional web traffic to visit the site. The additional web traffic from then overwhelmed the web server. Web traffic pattern analysis reports and web logging that was available did not demonstrate traffic that was indicative of a denial of service attack. But when did the truth ever get in the way of a man? Of a thing like Joe Lieberman? Not lately, that's for sure. It's hard for the truth to be involved in any kind of a relationship with Joe Lieberman as long as he's swanning around with the likes of the McCain-Jurian candidate. John McSame, John McBush, John Mick, if he gets into the White House in 2008, you can go ahead and stick a fork in us and turn us over because we're done. Jiminy Christmas. You know, I'm beginning to think we need to rethink our libel and slander laws. How many times do you reckon in the course of the campaign between August and November of 2006, how many times do you think Joe Lieberman used the accusation that that Ned Lamont had deliberately hacked his server as a means of trying to engender pity among Connecticut voters? A few, you think? More than once, maybe? Eh, could be. Tell you what, I'm gonna take one more run at getting Chris O'Brien on the line. We're gonna have a quick little interlude, and then we'll just get into the meat of things if it doesn't work out. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn. We'll be right back. oh, well, some days you get the bear and some days the bear gets you. This would be, I suppose, the latter of those two events. The bear got me. I don't know. Look, when you're doing this, it's Guy James says when things don't quite go as planned? Live radio. Yeah, that. Exactly. So we move on. We move on this Thursday evening. And, oh, what a beautiful evening it is here. It is everything, that I can do in my power, not to just, play the music and run outside and stand in the westering sun. Oh, it's gorgeous here today. It's beautiful. But that's okay, because we've got lots of slime and slime to wade through and swine to deal with. Just in case you were wondering, by the way, as far as the Iraqi-pation is concerned, it ain't ending anytime soon. I know, like you were under the impression that it's over day after tomorrow and we're having a parade. No. It's not only not ending anytime soon, it's going to be hammered into law, the Iraqi-pation, as an ongoing criminal enterprise. And here's the fun part. The Congress doesn't get to play. A senior State Department, this according to Agence France-Presse, a senior State Department official said today that the administration had ruled out fresh demands from top Democrats for any deal with Iraq on future U.S. troop operations to be submitted to Congress for approval. David Satterfield is the U.S. coordinator for Iraq. He testified to a Senate committee after top Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, expressed fears that the proposed deal would tie the hands of the next president. Duh! Now, if you go and you read that handy little pamphlet, around here we call it the Constitution, you'll find that the president negotiates treaties, but that he does so, and they only become law upon confirmation by the Senate. I know. Go figure. Look, what do you want the Congress mucking around in George Bush's business, huh? What, huh? But no, I'm sorry. That is just what it says, but that doesn't matter, because the Bush administration has decided that the treaty, because it's a treaty, that they're going to sign with Iraq, well, they've decided to handle it as an executive matter and an executive agreement. Huh? What? Go find, do me a favor, if you, you can do the search, you're not doing a radio show right now, call up the Constitution, go find executive agreement in the Constitution. You've got 2 hours and 35 minutes and 20 seconds. Go! Doesn't matter if I gave you 2 days and 25 minutes and 30 seconds. You wouldn't find it, because it's not there. The broken-down, dummied-up, faked-up, ginned-up, rubed-up Iraqi puppet government and the Bush administration are in the process of negotiating a status of forces agreement. Oh, it's another acronym. Yes, this is a SOFA. I told you there was a SOFA in Iraq. I told you that's where we lost $9 billion cash in the SOFA of the Coalition Provisional Authority. How many times have I said that? And all along, it turns out, there was going to be a SOFA. And believe you me, if you thought losing $9 billion in the SOFA was bad, wait till you see what we lose in this one. This is an even bigger SOFA. This is a money-eating SOFA. But I love the way Agence France-Presse phrases this. Iraq and the United States are set to negotiate a Status of Forces Agreement, SOFA, to legitimize U.S. operations in Iraq beyond the end of the year when the United Nations resolution governing their presence expires. Well, well, well. David Satterfield, whom I mentioned earlier, said in prepared testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations panel, "In keeping with past practice, our intent is to conclude the SOFA as an executive agreement rather than a treaty subject to Senate approval. We will continue to consult with Congress throughout the entire process as negotiations proceed in the coming months. But if you think you little pointy-headed devils are going to have anything to do with this, well, you're clearly deluded." Constitution? We don't need no stinking constitution. Hillary Clinton said, "I call on President Bush to pledge to the American people that the United States Congress will have the chance to review and vote on any long-term security agreement he has negotiated with the Iraqis." Memo to Hillary. There's only one way to stop this murderous little bastard. It's called impeachment. Call your little buddies over in the House of Representatives, Hillary, and tell them, all of them, that it's time to impeach this jerk, this tin pot dictator, this two-bit Mussolini. Because otherwise, the Congress of the United States is going to continue to be marginalized and made utterly irrelevant. The primary concern of the drafters of the Constitution of the United States, the element of our government that got top priority, that finds itself created right after the preamble, in Article 1 of the Constitution, the Congress, the representative body that was supposed to do the business of the people of the United States to create the laws, is going to become a laughingstock if it hasn't already. The Bush administration says that any deal would be similar to more than 80 such pacts with other nations around the world governing the scope of U.S. operations and providing protection for American soldiers. It says the pact will not specify troop levels, establish permanent bases in Iraq, or tie the next president's hands. Then why are you doing it? What do you need it for? If it's not doing any of that, what good is it? Committee Chairman Senator Joseph Biden pointed out that Clinton and fellow Democrat Barack Obama differ on Iraq strategy with Bush and presumptive Republican nominee John McBush, or McSame, I mean, or McCain, did it, or the McGoat, McEight-hundred-and-ninety-fourth out of 899 in his graduating class at Annapolis, McTemper Tantrum, McForrestall. There's only one way to stop this. And I guess it's a case of them being, the people in the Congress being there for so long that they can't see the forest for the trees. They have on their hands a usurper of their power. They have on their hands a dictator. They have on their hands a man who is pure poison to our constitutional form of government. And if they don't want this sofa, there is only one way to get the movers to come and take it out, and that is with George Bush on it. Impeachment and removal from office. Period. God Almighty, I'm sitting here in the hills and hollers of West Virginia, and I can figure this out. Mark Levin is sitting in Washington, D.C., and he can figure this out. Lord, the news report that came out from ABC that we talked about toward the very end of the horn section last night, busted, stone cold busted, Cheney, Condi, Colin, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, all of them sitting in on meetings approving of what they knew would be torture from 2002 forward. Hear the crickets? Now, on the other hand, we gotta give a little bit of got a little, give a little bit of credit where credit is due when, you know, when we're very, very good at hammering our elected representatives when they screw up. We also, I believe, have a duty to recognize them when they get something right. Got a little press statement out today from my Congressman Nick Rahal. U.S. Representative Nick Rahal, D. West Virginia, issued the following statement Thursday after voting to suspend the fast-track deadline for action by the House of Representatives on the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, giving the body more time to weigh in on the treaty. He said, "This administration's trade policies have dealt blow after blow after blow to West Virginia workers." Well, okay, to American workers. "The Colombian Free Trade Agreement is no different. It's been crafted by administration representatives who do not have the best interests of West Virginia at heart and who are putting American jobs at risk." First and foremost, the Congress has a duty to protect the peace and prosperity of the people of our own nation. Well, we ain't got no peace, and prosperity's, you know, done out of Dodge. In light of the economic downturn that is currently gripping our nation, it's okay, Congressman, you can say recession, because it's a Bush recession, by God, and they're doozies. "Our top priority must be to get our economy back on track. Fast-track procedures deny the people's representatives a meaningful voice in trade policies, and so I've voted to allow the Congress more time for greater scrutiny and a stronger hand in shaping this deal. We must look out for the concerns of America's working families here at home before agreeing to another dangerous trade deal that will increase unfair foreign competition and create a fast track to the unemployment line for American workers." Thank you, Nick. Good job. Got one right. Yay you. Proud of you. Now, the next step is to not ratify, to not approve the Colombian free trade boondoggle. Because, you know what? It's poison. It was poison when it was proposed. It's poison now. It'll be poison in the future. Colombian free trade. What are they doing a lot of in Colombia these days? Oh, yeah, coal mining. You know, the coal companies down there take out people who are union organizers and make them get all dead in the middle of the night with a couple of bullets in the back of the head. Wonder why we'd want a free trade deal with a country that's producing a whole bunch of coal. So maybe we can buy theirs while we ship ours to China? We wouldn't do anything so stupid as that, would we? Yes, why, yes, as a matter of fact, we would. The Congressman Rahal got this one right. Suspend the fast-track stuff and then put an end to this boondoggle. Look, why don't we... I got an idea. Why don't we just come up with a very simple, basic piece of strategery? What do you say that both houses of Congress decide that George Bush doesn't get another damned thing between now and November? Shut it down. Shut it down. Stop it. End it. Is that so hard to do? Would you be willing, as liberals, progressives, in other words, as decent human beings and real patriots in America, would you be willing to watch or to tolerate what would happen if the Democrats in Congress just said, you know, nothing else happens? Because if Nancy and Harry were sharp enough about it, they could win this fight. All they have to do is say, We have seen time after time that George Bush has no interest in working with us, so why should we have any interest in working with him? Right? Yeah, not a bad idea. Let's go to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Chris O'Brien.
Yeah, Chris, I had a feeling that was you.
Sorry, there was some problem with the phone. I couldn't hear when you called earlier.
Oh, yeah, I was just getting through to your voicemail, and I couldn't get an operator or anything. But no worries. I'm glad to have you here.
I'm glad I could make it. Let's do a mix-up.
You have no apologies necessary. You have my dream job. What are you doing with it?
Well, what I'm doing with it right now is preparing to go to the Craft Brewers Conference next week to organize. I'm doing a presentation on sustainability in beer and moderating a few panels with the likes of Ken Grossman, who's the owner of Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, the sustainability director from New Belgium Brewing, and a handful of other great, you know, great American craft brewers, and we get to sit around and talk about sustainability and beer all day.
I'm going to cry.
I'm kind of in heaven myself, to tell you the truth.
I told folks at the beginning of the program that we were hoping to have you on. I was afraid we'd had a mix-up with the time zones or something like that. Usually when I screw these things up, it's me screwing them up, so, you know, I take all responsibility. But I was profoundly bummed out because I really wanted to have this conversation, because being a liberal and being a progressive means that I march around through a lot of slippery, slimy, nasty stuff on the radio every night, and I wanted an opportunity to have this conversation with you to talk about the upside of a sort of an activism that you're advocating, that I can't imagine a better way to be an activist. You've got this book out, Chris, Fermenting Revolution. What's the upshot behind it?
Well, you know, it's kind of like what you just said, which is that there are a lot of stories out there about what's wrong, and this book is basically a story about what's right, in particular about how a grassroots movement of consumers, citizen consumers, beer drinkers, rejected the model that was being handed to them by the global corporate brewing industry, and instead said, hey, we're going to take this back where it belongs, which is in the kitchen. And once they took it into the kitchen and made something that was better than what they were being offered from a homogenized corporate model, their friends saw that what they were making in their kitchen was much better, and not just the beer, but the experience of bringing beer back into the home and the community, to a place where it's controlled by people instead of, you know, global corporations.
Now, is this, Chris, just a sort of an in-the-kitchen experience, or does this extend into a business model as well?
Well, as I was going to say, the result was that people saw that this was good, and they said, hey, can I get some of that? And that's when all those small homebrewers in the 80s started businesses, and that's how we went from 44 breweries in late 1970s to almost 1,500 breweries today, and almost all of those 1,500 breweries are small, independently owned, small traditional breweries.
So how does this connect? Tell me a little bit, if you don't mind, about the dark side. When you go out and you buy your corporate beer for the weekend or whatever, what are you really buying, Chris?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that even the global corporate brewing industry, from an environmental standpoint, compared to many other industries, is quite good. They've actually taken on social and environmental responsibility early on, and I think they were in part because they were forced to. They realized that as an industry that it has a perception problem. Some people have a bad perception about the role of alcohol in society, period. So the companies that produce alcohol felt a strong need to make sure that they were doing responsible business. So they addressed a lot of environmental issues early on. A lot of the big breweries are powered, up to 20% of their power comes from on-site generation from waste byproducts, for example. Coors Brewing Company invented the recyclable aluminum can specifically to start at curbside recycling programs. So there are some big good news stories. The bad news stories, from my perspective, is that, and this is not unique to the brewing industry, is that the corporatization of life is taking away what I find meaningful and valuable in life, which is non-monetary experiences, friends, family, relaxation, just kind of being alive. And when the last little refuge of being, to me, drinking beer with my friends is one of the most sacred experiences I can have. And when it's only a corporate experience, when it's moderated by the needs of a corporation, it removes the value of that social interaction. And what small breweries and home brewers have done is take that back, take that power back, so that people, that beer drinking is about people again, that it's an inherently social beverage. It's a beverage that is in, that strengthens community. But when big companies take power away from communities by turning something good like beer into something that's simply a marketing product. And, you know, when we're reduced to, when brewing companies reduce us to, frankly, blithering idiots by the kind of advertising that they present to us, the message that they're sending is beer drinkers are idiots, and we should have no self-respect, and because they clearly don't respect us. They, you know, the ads that you see on the Super Bowl appeal to the lowest common denominator. How to market a product to the lowest common denominator. And what craft breweries have done is tapped the fact that people don't want that. They want a meaningful experience. They want to go to a brew pub, a real place where a real product is made by real people right on site, and you can go and have your corner at the bar, or you can bring your family. You can have a very family-friendly experience. It's a community place, basically.
Very much on the model of the classic old English pub.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Well, I mean, a good friend of mine grew up there. She's passed away since. But she used to talk about when she was a girl growing up, what a pleasure it was at the end of the day. Everybody, the little kids included, trundled down to the local pub, and there was a kid's room in the next, and they played, and mommy and daddy had a pint, and they went home.
That's right. Yep. And the beauty of it is that it's not an exclusively monetary experience. Yeah, you don't have to go there just to spend money. You can go to a pub because you want community. In fact, studies have been done in England where they surveyed people in pubs and found that the number one reason they went to pubs was for the community experience. That was ahead of the actual desire to consume alcohol.
My head is just exploding with questions right now, Chris, so please bear with me as I try to wander my way through them. What you mentioned with community, I can vouchsafe for myself, because there was since my family's gotten a little bit older, I have not done the brewing that I did in the past, but there was nothing more enjoyable than having two or three guys. I remember an occasion, I believe it was in an early September, when about three of my other brewing buddies and I got together and got all our stuff together and made this giant batch of Christmas beer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, set it in the cellar. And then come Christmas time, there was this huge Christmas party. And, I mean, you couldn't get somebody to pick up a Budweiser. Everybody was on this handcrafted, craft-brewed, wonderfully flavored Christmas beer, and what it did for the social, you know, it was a Christmas party, and Christmas parties are fun, but it seemed like it really brought together a sense of togetherness that wouldn't have been there otherwise.
That's right.
And whether it's whether you're hefting one after a day of pushing the mower, or any other occasion, it's a much more real occasion. And I can't help but ask, you know, you mentioned earlier that some of these changes came on with the big brewers because they sort of had to. Isn't the volumizing of beer purchasing and beer sales, isn't the volumizing of it as opposed to the enjoyment of it, doesn't that contribute to the negative overall effects? Does that make any sense?
To a certain degree, and I think there are appropriate, there are times when you want to have a few, and there are times when you should just have one. And one of the great things that the craft brewing movement has done is focus on how to really enjoy quality. That this is not about, like you said, this is not about volume in this case. How to get away from the idea that you should get a cheap 30-pack weekender pack of
Duff.
Beer that doesn't have much flavor, let's just say.
Yeah.
And instead, you can have one or two really high quality, unique, full flavored, and I prefer to use the term full flavored rather than quality or low quality, because know, the beers from Anheuser-Busch and Coors and Miller and all the other big companies, they're high quality too. They're just not very interesting.
Yeah, they have massive quality control the organizations on site to make sure that it is, but it's the ubiquity, I think, is
right.
What you're getting at.
That's right. It's the conformity of it. And you know, and because those beers are so dumbed down in terms of flavor profile, it means that you can buy a lot of them and drink a lot of them. Whereas a craft beer, typically, because it's fuller flavored, it helps you focus more on the experience. It's rather than a purchasing and consumption experience, it's a focus on the moment. You know, enjoy the characteristics of this product and focus. You know, it's not just something to slam three of and or five of and
shotgun.
Right. Yeah. Right. Which is why I think one of the driving trends in the home brewing and craft beer movement is beer appreciation. You know, it's people sitting down and having a beer tasting where you sample, you know, little samples of a number of beers and you make notes and you judge the beers. And it's because the focus is coming back to the experience rather than the passive consumption.
Well, it points up the fact that there's every bit as much character in a mouthful of beer as there is in a mouthful of wine.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. In fact, I mean, you talk to anybody at a craft beer conference and they'll argue. In fact, a book just came out called He Said Beer, She Said Wine, and it's basically a debate between a sommelier and Sam Calagione, who is the owner of Dogfish Head Brewing Company.
Yes.
And they're arguing about, you know, which has more diversity and flavor, beer or wine. And if you ask me, it's hands down beer. And there's a pretty simple case to be made, which is that there are more ingredients in beer. So the combinations of those ingredients are infinitely more varied than wine, which has one ingredient. Whereas beer has multiple types of grain, can be flavored with any herb or spice. You know, it just has a much wider range of potential flavors. So therefore, it pairs better with food often because you have a wider range of flavors to choose from, so you can match the wide range of flavors of food.
Anybody who's ever sat down in an Irish pub and had a Guinness pie, or Guinness beef, something like that, knows the truth of what you just said.
Oh, yeah. Cooking with beer is a whole other thing.
Oh, yeah, and... Well, I did some beer-battered tempura shrimp just the other day, and, you know, that just made those shrimps sing.
Yeah.
As far as the book is concerned, Chris, are you trying to grow the idea of people doing their own brewing, or is this more a matter of reportage on a pre-existing phenomenon?
It's a little bit of both. It's like I said, it's partly telling a success story. So as a model to show people, look, you know, sustainability is not some distant goal. It's something that's happening right now. You know, and it's happening in some cases, as in the craft beer revolution. It's happening without a plan, without a top down approach. It happened from the grassroots up. It was people choosing something better.
It's an open source project in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a populist thing. You know, it's simply saying this is better. And what I like about using that as an example of sustainability at large is that sustainability is not about giving things up or decreasing your life experience. It's about improving your quality of life. And this is a great example of where a whole industry is changing that contributes to a higher quality of life, and at the same time is reducing environmental impact.
With some of the craft brews, the micro brews that are out there, is that why we see on the grocery store shelf, is that why we see import prices on domestic micro brews? Is it more costly to do it this way?
Yeah, it is. The ingredients are more expensive. To use high quality ingredients, and more to the point is, craft brewers use more of them. So, you know, and this, if you want to just measure this in straight alcohol terms, alcohol is produced from malted barley. So the more malted barley you put in, the more alcohol you create. But the more malted barley you put in, the higher price it is. So, you know, so you can't really compare a 5.3% Bud Light to a 7.5% IPA from a craft brewer because they're not the same product.
Oh, my mouth's watering.
The IPA is going to cost more because it's a different product. So, you know, in other words, it's not really apples to apples. So when people, and frankly, you know, I rarely get the question from people, why does it cost more? Usually, people are glad to pay more because they're getting something much more valuable. And the statistics show that. The craft beer industry has been growing in the double digits for the past several years, while corporate industrial light lager has been either dropping by a percent or so, or growing only by a percent or two at most, whereas craft beer is just exploding.
Is there any kind of a lobby movement out there, I hate that word, but for lack of a better one, to make it easier for craft brewers to enter the market on a state-by-state basis?
There are small fights going on all across the country because a lot of the regulations that are on the books are outmoded and outdated and precede the environment that we have now, which is 1,500 small independent businesses trying to operate in a regulatory environment that was designed to break up big companies. And so some of those regulations, when applied to a small business, end up putting those small businesses at a disadvantage to the big corporate behemoths, which was the opposite of what the laws generally intended. So there are laws that these are not just state by state, but also municipality by municipality, where I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is adjacent to the District of Columbia, and it's the only county in the country that has a county-controlled beer distribution system, which means if you're a small brewer, if you are located in Montgomery County, you have to sell your beer to the county and then buy it back. So
it's
an insane system. It was designed to make sure that big monopolistic brewing companies didn't control the whole marketplace. But today it has a negative effect, which is that, you know, there's a brewery up the street from here called Clipper City, and they have to I do tastings with them sometimes. We're going to do a book event on for my book, and they have to sell their beer to Montgomery County, and then when we go to the event, they have to buy the beer back from the county so that they can give it away at the book event. So, you know, there are, and there are also some states still have caps on the percentage of alcohol allowed in a product called beer. So, you know,
yeah, we're one of those here in West Virginia.
Oh, I think it's 6%, right?
Right.
I was actually just talking to a former brewer from the West Virginia Brewing Company last night.
Oh, you know, I love those guys.
Uh-huh.
They did great work.
Yeah.
And they sledded uphill all the way, Chris. You know, I don't think it's changed. We've got a squirrely sort of statutory setup here where if you brew it, you can sell it on premises. But if you sell it on premises, you can't retail it.
Uh-huh, right.
Or you can brew it for retail, but not sell it on premises.
Right. And see, that makes sense if what you're trying to do is make sure that a big brewing company doesn't own all the bars and you know, make so that you don't go into a bar and all the taps are from the one company. That was the intention, but now it means that small brewers who should be able to distribute on their own have to fight that fight state by state, and they are winning. They're winning all across the country. It's just a process and it takes time.
Well, I promised I wouldn't keep you on for too terribly long, but can you stay just long enough for me to get a few more questions in, please?
Absolutely. I'll talk all day.
Oh, okay. Oh, dear. You don't know what you just did. First of all, let's start with the person, and I was about to say the guy, but that would be incredibly sexist because I've known some women who have made some fabulous beer. A person wants to start homebrewing. What kind of money commitment are they into, Chris?
Depends on how crafty they are. If they're real crafty, they can get away with $20. If they're willing to, you know, scrape and scrounge and do what what I like to call repurposing of existing equipment and supplies, things that you can kind of scrounge. But if you want to buy a brand new set of equipment that will set you up with everything you need to brew, including the ingredients for your first batch, $150, and most of that is equipment that you'll have forever. So, on a per batch basis, once you're set up, the per batch basis is it's definitely cheaper to brew at home than it is to buy commercial beer. And you can brew beer that tastes absolutely just as good as the commercial beers. In fact, like I said, most of the successful microbreweries today were started by homebrewers.
You know, it's funny you would mention that because one of our hosts here on the network is down in Australia. And he's been raving about a little craft beer that he's getting in his shops now called Happy Goblin. Now, that's the free plug part of the program. It's a guy who just started out. He's a guy who just started out brewing beer, and everybody, oh, I love it. And he finally went pro.
Uh huh.
And he's got two or three styles out. But that kind of a story has been repeated 100 times at least all over the country and God knows probably thousands of times around the world, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is happening all over the world. I've been to South Africa. I've been to Chile, Vietnam. There are craft breweries, whole movements of craft brewers happening all over the world. All three of those countries have burgeoning small business brewing industries emerging right now.
And I can't help but observe, Chris, that this is a very, very potent means of teaching a responsible approach to alcohol.
That's right.
Because it's taking away the forbidden fruit of it, and it is enhancing the fact that this is an intensely personal experience that you don't want to ruin by going out and picking up a DUI.
Right.
So it's
part of the success story here is that the majority of Americans now live within 10 miles of their closest brewery. So we're getting close to the day where the average American can walk to a brew pub and eliminate the number one complaint most people have about alcohol, and this is obviously not related to beer specifically, but beer containing alcohol is part of the story, is that drunken driving is definitely a public health concern. And so if we can create walkable communities where you can walk down the street to your corner brew pub and have good beer and then walk home, you just eliminated that public health concern.
Yeah, because walking under the influence generally doesn't turn into tragedy very often.
That's right.
Let me ask then, okay, so if you're crafty about it, $20 to get started. If you just want to go with a prepackaged affair, $100 to $150, What do people get into when they go pro, Chris?
You mean in terms of cost?
Yeah.
It's this is a small business industry, so people start as small as I brewed at a small brewery in South Africa for just a few months. I helped this guy get his brewery going. We were brewing half barrel batches, which is five cases ish.
Yeah.
It was a glorified homebrew setup. So, and he scrounged it. It was a cast-off pilot brewery from South African Breweries, which is South African Breweries / Miller.
Right.
Just had an in-house pilot. It was the thing that they just did their test batches on to, come up with new recipes. And so they were just getting rid of it. And he bought it up for, probably the equivalent of a few thousand dollars. And that served as his entire brewery for his hotel. So, you can start, and that's how most of the craft brewers started, by finding cast-off equipment that, a lot of it was dairy tanks from dairy farms that were just getting rid of all the equipment, and then they just kind of jury-rigged everything from there. Now, today, you can get competitively priced, brand-new equipment, high-quality, very affordable for a small business startup. A great trend that's happening right now, as an example, is small canning machines. Most craft beer comes in bottles.
But right.
Environmental footprint standpoint, glass bottles are hugely intensive in terms of energy consumption, and they produce a lot of waste. And the recycling system. glass is not very efficient. Whereas both the quality and the environmental impact of an aluminum can is much better. Aluminum versus glass. Quality benefits are that aluminum is airtight. The enemies of beer is a fresh product.
Right.
So
yeah.
The enemies are light, oxygen, and the heat. So when you have a glass bottle, light, you know, glass is transparent, so light, a beer can be what a beer judge technically calls light struck, which means it's gone off from light. Likewise, it can be oxidized, which means the cap wasn't quite airtight and a little bit of air got in there and kind of ruined the beer. And thirdly, heat. You know, heat is something that's applicable to both glass and aluminum. But aluminum is airtight and opaque, so it eliminates two of the most common freshness quality problems with beer. And it has a much lower environmental footprint because it's lighter, it's more compact. Aluminum recycling is incredibly efficient. And so now craft brewers, because there are so many new small brewers, a company called Cask Systems created a tiny little canning system. Previously, you could only get a canning system, you know, if an old regional brewery was closing down and getting rid of a giant canning line that would cost tens of thousands of dollars. Now you can get a tiny little canning machine that does 4 or 8 cans at a time and takes up, you know, the size of my desk, and it costs $15,000. So a small business can afford that and can can their product at very small scale, you know, allowing small businesses to really compete against, you know, in another category against large breweries, which is the, you know, the canned market.
That's just fascinating. I want one.
Is
that something we should be on the lookout, you know, Sierra Nevada in a can, or the Rogue or something like that?
Absolutely. It's happening. I've got insider knowledge that I can't share publicly yet about one brand that is a household name that will soon be coming out with a can product, and I'm looking forward to that. There's a few, I don't know if you get this in West Virginia or not, you might get Fly Fox. From Pennsylvania?
I have seen it. I don't think it's on the... See, that's one of those regulation issues, because our the state has to buy all the beer here. I can't get... Well, until recently, I couldn't get a bottle of Whitbread because it just wasn't on the official state list, but I am familiar with Sly Fox, yeah.
Yes, they've got... I think they can 4 or 5 of their beers. I think the first company that did it is called Oscar Blues, and they're out of Colorado. They've got they've got award-winning beers out of a can. And, you know, most craft brewers, when they first hear this, kind of think, that can't be any good. It's a can. But when you do blind taste tests, judges don't know the difference.
Well, I'm a glass snob, too. I don't like to... I never understood why brewers put beer out in clear glass bottles, and you know the brand I'm thinking about, I'll bet.
Yep.
Or, for that matter, green glass bottles, because everything I always read said brown, 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 darker the better.
Yep. I'll tell you exactly why they put them out in green and clear, which is that it's good marketing, and that's the only consideration of that. Obviously, they're not considering quality when they do that. They're just considering marketing. And that's, again, you know, points up the fact that when a company becomes more a marketing company than a beer company, they've lost the heart of what their business is. And the results are that they start producing products that the singular focus is, how can we produce something that's maximizing profit, rather than saying, how can we produce something that is excellent and makes the world a better place? And that's what craft brewers.
Do you have a recommendation, Chris, for the first-time brewer as to a great starting style? Or, I mean, I would assume that a first-time brewer should probably start with a malt syrup and not try to be fracking grain and stuff like that.
Yeah, we actually did an experiment 5 or 6 years ago with Zymer G Magazine, the home brewer magazine, where we did an organic malt extract experiment, where we had several homebrewers brew with organic malt extract to specified styles, and then they were judged. And you can make an award-winning all malt extract beer, no problem. It's not hard, I will say, though, to use some grain. brewer myself, when I first made the jump up to using some real grain as opposed to extract, I couldn't believe how easy it was. So it's, you know, you can definitely go the
well. Even yeah, even if you're working from malt syrups, you can still enhance with a little bit of, you can enhance the quality of the malt syrup beer with a little bit of crushed crystal malt or a little bit of crushed amber malt for color. God knows you can enhance a can of stout extract with some crushed roasted malt and really bring out that roasty toasty quality. And that's a great way to proceed upward, you know, sort of by a stair step approach. Tell me, what's the last beer style that you brewed, or latest?
I like brewing with ingredients that grow in my yard. So I always I tend to add a little bit of honey because I have a beehive. So I've got my own honey that, you know, the bees are pollinating this. Now this gets into a little new realm here, but the bees from my hive are running around the neighborhood all day, pollinating all the flowers in the neighborhood. And so when I use their honey in my beer, what I'm basically doing is inoculating myself against.
Yes, you are.
What's the word? But you know, when you allergies.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
In D.C., people have a lot of allergies because D.C. is basically a swamp. We're built on a swamp, and so it's very humid and there's lots of diverse flora, which is great, but it means that there's a lot of allergies, and so I'm inoculating myself in the best way I could imagine with this thing here.
That's a beautiful thing. You ever do? I assume if you're keeping bees, you've done your fair share of full-on meads.
I've never done my own full-on mead. I plan to this year.
Oh, you got it.
I've tasted some other people's meads, and actually, I lived in Ethiopia, where the national drink is mead. So living there actually really turned me on to mead quite a lot. So I'm looking forward to
it. The only thing I noticed brewing mead, Chris, was that you've got to be a lot more patient with your yeast and sometimes even help it along a little bit because the sugars are not the same as the sugars that you necessarily get off of, malted barley.
Right.
So the yeast isn't in quite the universe that it's accustomed to. But, yeah. Oh, Lord, what an experience. My first batch of mead is a delightful story that I love to tell. My wife and I made it together. We used the recipe out of The Complete Joy of Home Brewing, which is, you know, it's still just a marvelous tome. Flavored it with lemon peel and ginger, and let it sit. And I was on my way home from work, called her, and she said, you know, honey, I'm going to do the cooking tonight. Yeah. And she said, great, I'll put a six-pack of the mead in. It's about time we tasted it. And it was ice cold, and I had done it sparkling, and I got to work on dinner, and I cracked it open, drank it just like a beer.
Uh-huh.
All 15% alcohol by volume of it, drank it just like beer. And it was a magnificent experience. It was something close to a religious experience.
Yeah, the nectar of the gods.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm a big mead fan. So you say you like to brew out of your yard and out of your garden. Have you ever done a spruce beer, for instance?
I've one of my favorite recipes is using juniper berries that I picked from a local park. I make a nice juniper berry porter, which is it's not spruce, but it's somewhat related. It has sort of the same. If you go too far with it, it can have the same resiny. You know, if you use too much spruce or too much juniper berry, you kind of end up having the same result because they're kind of related.
Well, exactly. Well, you use the wrong spruce and you're sort of dead in the water too, because all spruce is not the same.
Uh-huh.
But there are so many options out there, from barley wines to I'll never forget the first time that I poured a glass of purple lambic for my friends, and they went, "You expect me to drink this?" And I said, I not only expect you to drink this, I expect you to beg for more when you're done.
Yeah.
And they did.
Uh-huh.
And, if you go and you buy it commercially, you're into, you know, 5-6 bones a bottle for a genuine Belgian lambic, but with just a little bit of a learning curve, you can have it right in your own home, and you can blow people's minds.
Right.
And a little storage space, you can have a cellar going that would be worthy of a Trappist monastery in Belgium.
That's right.
And what I'm getting from you, Chris, is that what you're talking about in your book is the positive impact of that kind of a mindset. Is that fair?
Yep, exactly. And what I the diversity is part of the story here, and what I call it in my book is bureau diversity. And I basically talk about the idea of biodiversity, but I use craft beer as an example. So, you know, if you look across the country and look at hot spots or dead zones, which are ecology terms,
mm-hmm.
or globally there are hot spots of biodiversity, places where there are, you know, thousands and thousands of species located in one small little area. And then there are dead zones where, you know, we've literally created dead zones in the oceans where we've got floating miles worth of garbage floating in the oceans, and where those miles worth of garbage are floating, underneath them is dead. So I kind of use to explain that, I talk about beer and say, well, you know, look around America and think about 30 years ago, we were basically a biological dead zone. We had one style, you know, the equivalent of one species.
Right.
We had a monocrop of beer. We had a few different marketing brands, a few different companies, but they were all making the same style. And the result was, you know, a dead experience. There was no choice. There was no diversity. There was a dead industry. And when craft brewers entered and created this whole new scene of diversity, what you've seen since then is an explosion of life. You know, it's the exact same parallel with diversity of species of life as with diversity of species of beer. The more, the better.
And just a couple more questions, please, Chris. First of all, can you talk for a minute about the choices between organic versus non-organic ingredients?
Sure. From a quality standpoint, first and foremost, there are increasing numbers of professional commercial brewers who are opting for organic malt simply because they're higher quality. They have better extraction rates, which means, you know, you get more juice per pound of malt from organic malt than you do from non-organic malt. So that's strictly a productivity-based approach. From an environmental approach, the carbon footprint of organic malt is dramatically lower than the carbon footprint of conventional malt. And when I say conventional, what I really mean is chemically intensive, you know, agribusiness malts that are sprayed with chemicals. And when you put it in those terms, when you talk to a beer drinker and you say, do you want a beer that's made out of ingredients that were sprayed with chemicals, or do you want one that's made out of ingredients that have been grown the same way that we've grown ingredients for 10,000 years for beer, and produced all the beer styles in the world are based on this traditional organic method of agriculture. When you put it in those terms, people say, well, yeah, I don't want chemicals sprayed on the ingredients in my beer. But most people don't think of that when they reach for a beer and it says all natural on it. So they think, oh, this is a good natural product. When in reality, the brewer may have adhered to good brewing practices and not added any chemicals at the brewing stage. But unfortunately, those ingredients were tainted from the time they entered the brewery. So they were already grown intensively with chemicals. So, you know, there's the productivity and the quality issue that breweries are already recognizing. And then there's the, you know, if you care about farmers, this is really, the other argument here is that small family farmers are going out of business across the country. And it's because they're being put out of business by large corporate agriculture.
And when we talk about family farmers, we're talking about people who raise barley, but we're also talking about people who raise hops. I mean, massive hops farms in the Great Northwest.
In fact, there are some hops being grown some organic hops being grown in West Virginia now.
Really?
I blogged about it on my blog, which is beeractivist.com. I blogged about it just a few weeks ago. If you go there and do a search on the blog for organic hops, you'll come up with a little story about a farmer who emailed me from West Virginia saying, hey, I'm putting in a few acres of organic hops this season. Let your readers know about it because they can order direct from
me. Acres?
Yeah. Yeah, he's producing at commercial scale.
That's amazing.
There are farmers doing that all across the country now with organic hops.
Well, is the idea of organic barley also bringing people back to the tilth, so to speak?
You know, most most barley is grown by a couple countries, a couple companies. And they're creating, they recognize that there's a niche market for organic, so they're providing for that small niche right now. I'm not aware of small farmers independently growing organic barley, but I couldn't say for sure.
Okay.
I can say that the big story is that when farmers make their own choices about how to sustain the land over the long term, they choose organic methods. When they're trying to answer to short-term needs based on pressures from suppliers that are pushing chemicals on them, they respond by, oh, I'll try this chemical out. Then the next year they find they have to use a little bit more of a chemical because they're stressing the soil by using those chemicals rather than building the soil, which is what organic agriculture does. So when small independent farmers who are on their land for life and want to pass it on to their children, when they're thinking about farming methods, they choose organic because they know they want to build the quality of the soil so they can pass on something with value to their children. But when companies are doing it, they're doing it for short-term, immediate returns, and they're not thinking about another generation, let alone 5 or 10 years down the road.
And brewing, of course, is water-intensive, Chris. What about water purity, water quality?
Good question. The brewers think of this in terms of the water-to-beer ratio. So how much water does it take to make a unit of beer? So, for example, 10, 15 years ago, the industry average was somewhere around 10 gallons of water per gallon of beer. Now that industry average is down to 6 or 7, but some brewers have it down as low as 3. So, you know, there are a whole host of things that you can do in a brewery that reduce your water needs, and a lot of them are just basic common sense, but a lot of times people forget about basic common sense, and in this case, it's just things like fixing leaks, turning off faucets when you're not using them. Those things add up, and you know, when you've got an industrial operation that uses water and you've got leaks in all your hoses, and those hoses are running for a 12-hour or 14-hour brewing shift, you're wasting water all day long every day. When you plug those leaks, you're saving money, but you're also saving water. And you know, brewers, when they put their mind to it, they can focus on some of those improvements and realize cost savings as well as environmental benefits.
Well, when people I want people to buy the book, naturally, but I'm a proponent myself, as you can probably tell, of brewing your own. If they go out in search of brewing supplies, is that something that you guys can handle out at Seven Bridges?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The company's website is breworganic.com. We have a retail store in Santa Cruz, California, but 75-80% of our business is mail order. We send stuff all over the country. You can get it if you have a mailbox. We can send you brewing.
That's wonderful, and I got a question from somebody who's already been to your website, Chris. Could you address the coffee issue a little bit real quickly?
Yeah, well, my other favorite beverage is coffee, and my next book is on coffee. It'll probably be out in about a year, and it's somewhat of a similar story. There are a handful of large global food companies that market most of the coffee in the world, but in the last 25 years, there's been a massive resurgence of small, community-oriented, locally-owned coffee roasters, and that's the subject of the next book. And we also this is also something that you can do at home, very cost-effective, pays for itself immediately. If you're going to a grocery, if you're buying gourmet coffee or what's called specialty coffee, that costs $7, $8, $9, $10 a pound at a grocery store, you can easily save at least half of that cost by roasting your own beans at home in a machine that takes up no more space than a coffee brewer does.
Oh, amazing. I had no idea.
Yep. And we sell all that at Seven Bridges, too.
Okay, so all of this can be had through breworganic.com?
Yep. We've got lots of tiny little roasters, and you can buy a variety pack of different kinds of beans from us, and literally all you do is open the package, open the lid and pour it in and turn it on. 15 minutes later, you've got roasted coffee. It's the freshest coffee you'll ever get. And coffee, just like beer, is best when it's a fresh product. As soon as you open a commercial bag of coffee, it starts degrading. So if you're roasting it, and what I've got at home is I roast it, then it goes right into a grinder brewer that's all one machine, and it's, you know, small. It sits on my countertop, so I've got the freshest coffee you can get.
You know, Chris, I had a feeling I could talk your ear off, but I had no idea where all this was going to go. And I've got a far greater sense now of what you're really talking about with these being freedom issues. The freedom to have your coffee taste the way you want it. The freedom to be able to pull a beer out of your fridge or out of your cellar and not be committed to one particular style, and have it actually meet your palate the way that a wine connoisseur would pull a Pinot Grigio or a Pinot Noir or a Merlot or a Cab or anything like that. That's all available to the home beer brewer.
That's right.
And
you know, I think you put your finger on it. And when you said freedom, that's really forgetting about quality or preferences for one thing or another. What we lose when a few companies control an entire market is we lose freedom. Companies are not beholden to us. Companies create a product and then they market it to us. What people do is create something that they want. So, you know, the ideal economy, the way that the economy is supposed to work is that somebody wants something, so somebody else makes it for them. But that's not the way it works with large corporations.
No, here it is. This is what you want.
Exactly. Yep. And so we've lost, you know, America, the great democracy, we've lost our freedom to participate in a democracy because corporations are making our decisions for us, and we have very little recourse. So when we can take things back into our own hands and, you know, like I said, take it back into the kitchen, that's where most good things happen. And that's exactly what the specialty coffee and craft brewing movement have done, taking it back into the community and the home.
Well, I wish you the very best with the book, and I envy you profoundly events that you get to go to and the tastings and so forth. If other things develop or as other ideas strike you, I hope you will consider this a friendly place and a place to go with new information. We haven't even gotten into the real geekery of beer styles, and I could take your whole night, but I really, really hope that you'll come back and tell us what you're finding out, talking to people around the country, and maybe we'll have some success stories to share with you about folks out in the Horn audience who've decided to, break free, if you will.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Bob. Just to remind people, the book is called Fermenting Revolution. It's available in any bookstore or online. You can go to my blog, which is beeractivist.com.
And I have a sneaking suspicion it's also available on our website now, too. So I can't wait to get my hands on it and get a good read. And best of luck to you. Tell the bees we said we hope they're happy. And let me know when the first batch of mead rolls out.
Very good.
All right, Chris O'Brien, thank you very, very much. You've really made my evening.
Cheers, Bob.
Cheers to you. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Chris O'Brien, the website again, beeractivist.org. He has a blog. There's all kinds of fascinating articles there, a list of events. There's a direct link to breworganic.com. If you're a beer drinker, are you a little bit curious now? Would it just be really, really, really cool to have a case of this and a case of that sitting around in a nice, dark, cool place? And say, you know, hey, would you like a porter or a stout? Oh, wait, it's really hot outside. Let's have that nice, crisp lager that I... Yeah, all of that can happen. 10 cents a bottle? Oh, we're going to use the expensive stuff. It'll be a quarter a bottle. And you're off the beer grid. And since you're using, you know, real, live, honest-to-God yeast in the process, you're also involving yourself in a health process, because down at the bottom of that beer bottle is this little layer of sediment, and it's yeast. And you know what else that means it is? that also means that it is an absolute loading dose blast of B12. I can tell you from experience, you feel a lot better getting up in the morning after having had a handful of home brews than you do getting up in the morning after a handful of corporate brews, because you've had all that B12 going into your system all along. Plus, it's food. Do you realize that the German beer purity law, and I'm going to get to the phones in a minute, the German beer purity law, which is called the Reinheitsgebot, specifies that beer, and it goes back to the 17th century, beer may consist of water, malt, malted barley, hops, and yeast. That's it. Guess what? Budweiser can't pass the Reinheitsgebot. Miller can't pass the Reinheitsgebot. Most American corporo beer can't pass the Reinheitsgebot because it contains, well, go, you know that Budweiser label with Budweiser contains only the finest, yada, yada, yada. Go read, what's the first word? Hint, rice. Ain't no rice in the Reinheitsgebot. But rice is a hell of a lot cheaper than barley. But you sure wouldn't know it to pay for it, would you? All right, let's see what's going on the phone lines here. Oh, somebody quit. Yep. Doggone it. So, styles? What do you like? You ever had a porter? As you can tell, I'm a fan. Oh, dear, I'm geeking. I need to get back to being really angry about the mean, rotten, nasty things happening in the world. But those little moments that we have where we can know that we are absolutely free and that we have done something that puts us in touch with human beings going back 7,000 years. Isn't that worth maybe thinking about? And, you know, you're talking about some plastic. You're talking about a couple of 7.5-gallon plastic buckets. You're talking about some plastic tubing, food grade, a jug of bleach, a collection of bottles, some caps, a real cheap capper, and a couple of other things if you really want to get a little bit scientific about it and gauge the specific gravity and calculate the alcohol content of the beer and all of that stuff. It ain't much. And the initial investment yields big-time results. I'll never forget the first time I opened a bottle of dark black German-style Dunkel flavored with ginger. Holy cow. You want to talk about yummy. Instead of hops. Because hops is a flavoring agent, but also it also has a preservative quality to it. That's why an India Pale Ale, for instance, is absolutely loaded with hops to the point that some of them will turn your mouth inside out. They're so hoppy, and that was to help it. It's literally India Pale Ale because it was brewed in Britain and shipped all the way around the Horn to India. And the hops acted as a preservative to get it to the British colony there. Oh, it's such a wonderland. It is such a marvel. Let's see what's cooking on the phones this time. Hi, who have I got?
Sin.
Hey, long time no talk to. How are you?
I might live after all.
The rumors of your demise were greatly exaggerated?
Well, for a while there, I was sincerely hoping somebody would come along and shoot me.
Oh. Well, I heard that you weren't well, and I just... When I hear that people are sick, I tend to leave them alone, because even the greatest of well wishes tend to make people, oh, hell, now I have to write back. You know, don't want to do that to anybody.
Yeah, just go away and leave me, let me die, you know, that type of thing. The reason I called is because I don't drink, but this guest you just had, he made me want to start.
And you know, that's, yeah, and the idea of the freedom, yeah. But you know, a lot of the principles that he was talking about, Susan, are such that they can be applied to other things. The freedom principles that he's talking about extend to, you know, opening your own jar of raspberry preserves instead of getting it from Smucker's or Welch's or whatever.
I already do that.
Well, exactly, and that's what I'm getting at. You're participating in that off-the-grid process.
Yeah. Well, the reason I called is because I was wondering, are there any non-alcoholic goodies that you can brew?
Oh, gosh almighty, yes. Oh, merciful heaven, make your own root beer. You haven't lived till you've had your own root beer. Now, you might, now if you want to make it naturally carbonated, you'll have a little teeny tiny bit of yeast and a little teeny tiny bit of corn sugar for it to live on. So it'll, because, you know, one of the byproducts of yeast is CO2, and that's the origins of carbonation. CO2 does not come in a tank all the time. So, you know, it would be a content that would be almost negligible in trying to measure for it. A ginger, the origins of root beer and ginger beer and all of those herbal root infusions are much the same process as what you're talking about in beer brewing.
Because, you see, my problem was, it's not a moral thing with me.
No, it's a physical thing. You can't.
Well, not only that, I object to the taste.
Let me call a fast time out on that one, Susan.
I object to the taste of the alcohol. I love the taste of really good scotch, but I can't stand the taste of the alcohol in it.
Well, then what we're talking about here, what Chris was talking about with the ubiquity of what is referred to as American corporate lager or American light lager, it all tastes largely the same. You know, the closest that any Budweiser ever gets to hops is the picture of the hop blossom on the can, because you darn sure can't taste any of it inside. And when people say, you know, I don't like beer, I don't like how beer tastes, they're talking about American light lager. Because, for instance, the yeasts themselves, oh my God, I have geeked so badly. It's been so long that since I talked about something I actually enjoy. The yeasts play a profound role. For instance, the great German Urweisse, Weisse being wheat, the great German wheat beers, where wheat replaces all or some portion of the barley, there's a particular yeast that gets used in that gives off phenols, which are, you know, chemical compounds, which taste like other things. And in a classic German wheat beer, you get this byproduct from the yeast fermentation that tastes like a cross between bananas and butterscotch.
Oh my goodness!
And a little, and it's frequently served with a little squeeze of lemon. And it's just, it'll make you sing. The stuff that the late great, and I forgot to mention it to him because I'm sure Chris would have liked to have paid tribute. In the last year, we lost the greatest proponent for the appreciation of beer that the world has ever known, a gentleman by the name of Michael Jackson. Not that one. Most of the people out there who went off on their search for their favorite beer styles and an appreciation of beer styles did so because at some point in time they read Michael Jackson's work. Michael Jackson was really big in an operation called CAMRA in the UK, which was the Campaign for Real Ale, encouraging a return to England and Scotland and Ireland's and Wales's roots in traditional top fermented ales. I learned a lot from him, and I went off tasting stuff, and he used to call Belgium the Disneyland of beer, Susan, because there is everything in the Belgians took beer and did for it what the French did for wine. It's just that the Belgians never really got the marketing credit, and there are beers there that I mentioned, in you may have heard the word lambic. There's a beer styled called lambic, Susan, that is open fermented. Usually when you're brewing, you want to make sure that no nasties get into your beer, like wild yeasts or lactobacillus or stuff like that. Well, when they brew the lambics on the farm breweries in Belgium, they have wooden fermenters that are open-topped, and the breweries themselves have, like, spider webs up in the corner, and it's all, you know, very, very back to... Because these things are hundreds of years old, and they are deliberately fermented with a particular form of wild yeast that only exists in like a 20-mile radius in Belgium. But you can get pretty close, even in the U.S. and it makes a beer that's incredibly sour. And because it's incredibly sour, it's also incredibly responsive to fruit sugars. So then they take cherries or peaches or strawberries or raspberries and do a maceration of those fruits inside the sour first fermentation, and they get a whole second fermentation. And to have a Creek Lambic, which would be the cherry, blow your mind. It is delicious beyond... Agnes doesn't drink, and Agnes loves Creek.
Ooh.
The Trappist doubles and triples that have been brewed since 1056.
Well, that's what it sounded like. It was like it was straight out of the Middle Ages.
Well, some of this stuff is. There's a what's the name of it? I just love it. It comes in a 750-milliliter champagne-style bottle with a champagne-style cork. And I can't remember the name of it now, but it's been brewed since 1056 in Belgium. And it's a triple. And it's blonde, and it's just gorgeous. And pairings with, you know, you pair different beers with different foods, with fish, with beef, with pork, with chicken, with vegetables. There are dessert beers. The famous Scots ales. Goodness gracious, barley wines that can age for 20 years on a shelf just like wines can, and most Americans know nothing about any of this because they've been fed a steady diet of, you know, that stuff that comes from the Clydesdales.
Yeah.
You know, I do my own little bit of proselytizing. I introduced my son-in-law to a couple of different beer styles, and he was like, wow. And I went, yeah, there's a whole world of it out there. But yeah, objecting to the taste, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. You know, the first thing you ever hear is, you know, beer is an acquired taste. Well, you have to acquire it because so much of it's nasty. You know, Pine Sol's an acquired taste too, I guess.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, there is still that medical issue I have to get around, and unfortunately, I don't think I'm going to be able to do that.
No, I don't think they will either. But if the sugars and stuff are no issue for you, there's a lot of online resources for brewing your own sarsaparilla root beer, ginger beer, that kind of stuff. And man, is it fun!
In fact, I'm under doctor's orders to consume sugar. One of the very few people I know of who are.
Well, yeah, you've got to hammer the Pepsi every day.
Yeah.
You would probably like hammering your own homemade root beer or homemade colas, for that matter, a lot more.
Oh God, that sounds good.
Oh, it is. It is. And you can.
Have you ever heard of something called Green River?
Green River what? Beer?
No. It's native to the Pacific Northwest. And it's a soft drink.
No.
I was wondering if it's possible to brew it yourself. Because
if you're looking for a brewing recipe, or any kind of recipe, there's a great resource out there called Uncle Phaedrus. Phaedrus. Uncle Phaedrus, just Google Uncle Phaedrus. The Uncle Phaedrus website has every recipe just about known to man.
Cool.
You know, whether it's your favorite recipe from your favorite restaurant, or, you know, salad dressings and beverages, and, you know, how is this burger made and what makes it taste so good. And he gets to the bottom of it, and he does. I haven't been there in a while, so I'm not sure, but I assume he's still there, and he does fabulous work. So if you want to find out about it, the best place, that would be the place that I would start.
Yeah, because, you know, if they can come up with, you know, if I could come up with, you know, non-alcoholic things, that would be really neat to get into, I think.
Well, look up root beer brewing, and you might find some stuff. Just by going to Chris O'Brien's website, the Beer Activist blog. And let's see, I'm showing this at beeractivist.wordpress.com. But, you know, if you just look him up, Beer Activist, it'll take you right to it. And, you know, I think he probably answers questions and stuff, and he's got an email feed and RSS and all that fun stuff. I know that in the Complete Joy of Homebrewing, there is some limited information presented regarding root beers and the like. So, you know, the information's out there.
Biden stuff.
Yeah. Well, I am glad to know that you're back among the living. To slow you
back.
Bless your heart, to slow you down, you must have felt awful.
I spent the better part of the last 4 days crashed in bed. Just dying, wishing somebody would come along and shoot me. Oh, God, it was bad.
Anyway, wonderful.
Yeah, it's the mother and father of all head cold. For those that are interested, Randy Rhodes has been hired on to Nova Am.
Mm-hmm.
Starts on the 14th.
Kind of saw that coming.
Yeah, well, so did I. Yeah. I will get busy on Centab as soon as I can. I'm way behind on that.
Well, you know, no hurry.
I miss a day, and I just... There's so much news those two people are generating that it's incredible.
And it's really cool. Chris just popped into the chat room too, so that's exciting.
Cool.
Yeah.
Great. Anyway, I will let you go, and I'm sure you have Twinkies. And you give Agnes my love.
All right. How's Donald?
He's trucking along. He's still on oxygen, but he's going to be on that for a while. They want him on that for a while. But he tows around his little tank.
Good.
There he goes.
Well, tell him we're thinking of him, please.
Okay. I'll do that.
All right. Susan, you have a wonderful evening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. Let's roll. Ah, darn it. That happens. Sometimes, if you're new to the program, we have real conversations here. It's not mega dittos, Bob. Well, thank you. Next caller. We don't do that. So you kind of got to have just a little bit of patience and bear with us a little bit. From our pal Marty, for those who can handle it, tell them to find a good beer festival. Marty is back from the bondage called jury duty. Bless your heart, Marty. That'll teach you to get a driver's license. If they do it out there like they do it here, jury duty's culled from the driver's license list. Oh, a beer festival. See, that's one of the downsides sometimes of being in a remote, secure, undisclosed locations amid the hills and hollers of West Virginia. Not a lot of beer festivals. And I'm really, really envious when Chris said, you know, we're getting to the point where a majority of the population is within 10 miles of a brew pub. Not this one. But, you know, patience is a virtue, and I think it's time for me to get the brewing stuff back out. Because, wow, yummy. If you're a beer drinker, try something different once in a while. Even if you try a style that you hate, you know, you're out $6. And you'll be the better for it because you're liable to find something that you love. Let's see. It's about a quarter to eight here on the East Coast. Anything on your mind? I know. But look, cut me some slack, will you? Please. This stuff actually matters. This is you know, what Chris was talking about, and to extend it, you know, canning your own, getting off the grid. This is really important stuff because once you've empowered yourself that way, all of a sudden you feel like you're probably in a pretty good place to start demanding that, there's a nexus. There is a link between learning to do that kind of stuff and doing that kind of stuff. And the urge to stand up and be heard and exercise your sovereign rights as a member of this fast fading republic. Right? I mean, do you see the connection? I hope so. Other stuff that's out there, you know, it was so pleasant, I almost... I almost hate to wade back into this swill. You know, the stories that... God, I love the guys at WD40.com. You know, the way they name their links. A story, headline, while reservists serve, their jobs don't always wait. What's it say at the link? Bush F's up everything. And you know, how true that is. Somebody, tell me one good thing. And this is not an invitation to that wonderful scene from The Life of Brian. Tell me one good thing the Romans have done for us. No, tell me. Tell me one good thing that the Bush administration has done for the United States of America. One. He's kept us safer. No, he hasn't. From the Christian Science Monitor, though, the story that the boys at WD-40 were referring to on the main page, while reservists serve, their jobs don't always wait. Between 2004 and 2006, returning volunteers filed 16,000 complaints against employers. God forbid the Bush administration should actually enforce the law. Well, see, that's the problem with government. Government doesn't work. Yeah, we can't. And I got another one of those. But wait, before I get all, you know, all jumpy all over the place, the article by Jill Carroll from the Christian Science Monitor opens, Steve Duarte worked in human resources for the same company for 19 years. But within months of returning from Iraq with his Marine Reserve unit in 2003, his second military deployment in 2 years, he was told his job was ending in a week. And, you know, like I said, there's 16,000 of those in the naked country. As the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan grind on, tensions are mounting between the military's civilian volunteers trying to step back into their professions and employers straining at times to cope with a growing cadre of workers who are away at war for months and then expect to regain their former jobs. A 1994 law, the Uniformed Services Employment and Redeployment Act, which is USERA, hell, at least it doesn't spell sofa. Honest to God, I'm going to have a fit if the Bush administration comes up with some dummied-up, ginned-up, faked-up, rubed-up plan for screwing up Iraq or Afghanistan or the rest of the country or whatever, and calls it. If they come up with one called beer, I'm marching on Washington. Okay. Anyway, the 1994 law gives workers that right. In other words, the right to come back to their former jobs, along with other promotions or benefits they would have earned had they not been deployed. Wait a minute. 1994? Wouldn't that have been long about when all the right-wing, ugly little fascist punks were screaming about how Bill Clinton don't like the military? Well, wrong again. If he hated the military the way that the right wing claims, God knows he'd never have signed that into law, now would he? With more than 600,000 reservists and guardsmen mobilized since September 11, 2001, thousands have found their jobs gone or positions diminished when they returned. Ouch. Oh, our buddy, Walmart. Last week, the Department of Justice said it's suing Wally World, alleging that it failed to reinstate a cashier who was an Air Force reservist. They're also suing United Parcel Service, charging that it eliminated the job of another Air Force reservist while he was on active duty in Iraq in 2003. Don't worry, however. It's probably all a fraud. I'll explain why in a minute. Work with me here. Jesus God. Now, we just went through all the business of Deborah Shanks and the rotten crap that she was subjected to by Walmart. And we find out that the whole time they're out there screwing reservists. And yet, can't you buy support the troops crap at Walmart? Last I checked, you can. Ah, sweet Jesus. Experts say that the law is a ticklish issue for companies. Well, you know, whenever companies have to obey a law, you find them running up against those ticklish issues. They get ticklish because, you know, it tickles them to can the people and save the money and hire a new guy. You know, you've had the guy for 19 years. He's got 19 years of salary increases. He's got 19 years of seniority, probably vested in some sort of an IRA or a 401k912. And, boy, a lot easier to can him and hire the new guy at the base rate, isn't it? Now, it's a ticklish issue for companies. On the one hand, they don't want to do anything that makes them look unpatriotic. On the other, the long and sometimes repeated deployments of key personnel can complicate staffing. Well, you know what? Somebody called George Bush about this because the Democrats didn't do it to him. Now, listen, I know. We got problems with the Democrats. Problems with they have with the Democrats, though, are largely tied to inaction, not proactive. The problems we have with George Bush, however, are the screwing of the economy, the war. You know, it all comes back to the Iraq occupation. Everything is tied to the Iraq occupation. Employment numbers, general malaise of the country, rising gasoline prices, rising food prices, rising beer prices. It all comes home to the Iraq occupation. But Jill Carroll, reporting for the Christian Science Monitor, says, no one knows how big the problem is. Members of the reserve forces filed some 16,000 formal and informal complaints with the government from 2004 through 2006. That's according to the GAO. And that's the most recent data available. But she reports that that may underestimate the number who actually encounter rehiring problems. And here's the tragic part. Some just sue on their own. Some don't go through the USERRA process. Most apparently take no action at all. It's called the lumpet factor. DOD surveys indicate that 70% of reservists who said they had problems getting rehired or promotions or raises didn't do a damn thing about it. Not a thing. God, where's Lee Greenwood when we need him? If only he could sing and make it all better. Just sickening, sickening, sickening. I said work with me here. Well, there's a story that sort of dovetails with what I just shared with you. A New York Times story from yesterday. Chat room moderator ELO sent this along. I think it came with some dirty words because it really pissed her off. In 2005, federal authorities concluded that a Monsanto consultant had visited the home of an Indonesian official and, with the approval of a senior company executive, handed over an envelope stuffed with $100 bills. God bless him. I want to talk about beer some more. Please? God, this is annoying. With the approval of a senior company executive, handed over an envelope stuffed with $100 bills. The money was meant as a bribe. No, really? God, you can't get anything past the New York Times, can you? It was meant as a bribe to win looser environmental regulations for Monsanto's cotton crops in Indonesia, according to court documents. And then Monsanto got busted as well for concealing the bribe with fake invoices. It's always the cover-up that gets you. A few years ago, the article notes, these kind of charges probably would have resulted in a criminal indictment. Not anymore. Hey, remember when George went to Wall Street and said, hey, we're going to crack down on the corporate criminals. Yeah, we're taking this stuff seriously. Well, it depends on... Yeah, they took it seriously. But, you know, it's the music that happens between the notes. It's in the silences, really. No, instead, this time through... Oh, stand by. It's spring, allergy season. Sorry. You didn't want to hear that. No, instead, Monsanto was allowed to pay $1 million... $1 million? And avoid criminal prosecution by entering into a monitoring agreement with the Justice Department. I know a guy down the road who was building an addition on his house. And a guy from the county came by and said, I'm going to have to fine you if you don't get a permit. The guy looked at him and said, how much is the permit? $100. Looked at him and said, how much is the fine? $50. Fine me. This is that. In a major shift of policy, the Justice Department, once known for taking down giant corporations, including Arthur Andersen, has put off prosecuting more than 50 companies suspected of wrongdoing over the last 3 years. You remember the big frou-frou that was had? Oh, Massey Energy's been fined $20 million. Well, how much were they charged? You know, it would have been enough almost to break Massey and should have been, you know, prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But this happens. Because the Bush Justice Department couldn't be trusted with a handful of caca. In a major shift of policy, the Justice Department, once known for taking down, did you hear that part? Once known for taking down, now lets them off the hook. American Express avoided the cost of defending itself against criminal charges with a deferred prosecution agreement. Let's say little Johnny gets busted with a pocket full of crack. Does little Johnny get a deferred prosecution agreement? Well, you know, if little Johnny's the son of the CEO of American Express, maybe little Johnny does. But mostly little Johnny is not the son of the CEO of American Express, so little Johnny doesn't. Firms, oddly enough, have readily agreed to the deferred prosecutions. Because clearly it avoids a bigger headache for them. Some lawyers suggest that companies may be willing to take more risks because they know that if they're caught, the chances of getting a deferred prosecution are good. Quote, this is a quote from, why do you gotta do this to me? Vikramaditya S. Khanna, a law professor at the University of Michigan, said some companies may bear the risk of legally questionable business practices if they believe that they can cut a deal to defer their prosecution indefinitely. Of course, other legal experts say that the tactic has, of course, sent the wrong signal to corporations, that it turns out that they understand now that from the Bush administration Justice Department, they've got a get-out-of-jail-free card. It also, the article notes, provides a roadmap of how we can expect the Bush Justice Department to deal with the criminal ins and outs of the Ponzi scheme that was the subprime crisis. Of course, I'm a little bit more of a cynic. I don't expect anything to be done by the Bush administration Justice Department about the subprime crisis. Nothing at all. because, you know, why would you? Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, where are we? I mean, I don't know about you. This is just It's not bad enough that these guys hardly ever go to prison. Now we can't even attach the stigma of a felony conviction to Monsanto. Imagine the stigma of a felony conviction for poor little Monsanto. That won't be able to get a, it won't be able to get a minimum wage job. Oh wait, that's little Johnny with a pocket full of crack. Never mind. Just beats all, doesn't it? Just wears you out. Tax day's coming. You better file. Monsanto, you know, if they get around to it. Amex, you know, maybe. But no, they'll probably joyously file because they'll because the CEO of Monsanto will likely pay less a lower tax rate than you will by the time all is said and done. Let's take a break. This is The Horn. We'll be back. Call in if you want to talk. I'm Bob.
Some way that we may have yet to be. hard cost. Oh, can we call it a loan? And a debt that I owe, or a bet that I lost.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
All righty, absolutely. Hour three underway. Seven minutes past the hour of 8 o'clock here on the East Coast. And let us not fiddle-de-diddle around any at all. Let's go to the phones and see who we've got. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, this is Alan.
Hey, Alan, how are you, buddy?
Hanging in there. I'm on the way to Birmingham.
Are you really?
Yeah, nice day to be driving.
Oh, what a beautiful day it was here. It was just gorgeous. I think it probably got up past 70 here in the hills.
Wow. Hey, since you're an Alabamian, did you ever go to a brew pub in Birmingham during the 90s called the Magic City Brewery?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, I absolutely did. That was a wonderful place. Great food and fabulous beer.
We were probably in there at the same time. I went there every day.
Did you really?
About a mile from my house.
No kidding. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. God, what section of town's that in? I know it wasn't a far drive from where I was staying.
It was like almost the downtown part, south side part of town.
Yeah, it was on the south side of Birmingham, and it wasn't too far from the UAB campus.
Yeah, that's right. It was real close to that, and a lot of the people who worked for UAB came by there and ate lunch.
And there was another little brew pub in Birmingham up by Little Five Points.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of that one. That was a pretty good one also.
Is Magic City still a going concern?
No, it closed down. Somebody decided to buy it and make what they call a tiki bar out of it. And
oh,
that didn't
for...
last long at all. They took out all the big vats for making beer and tried to make what they call a tiki bar, and now it's nothing at all, just an empty building.
Yeah, because it had been an old automobile showroom, hadn't it?
What it looks like it used to be with all the glass.
Well, I remember. I think there was still the last vestiges of the name of the car dealership painted on the wall.
I missed that part. I thought it looked great the way they had it, with the beer, those big beer bats were in the middle in a glassed-in area, and you could look in and watch them making the beer, and you could sit down and drink a beer when you were.
And they had those brick oven, the pizza ovens, wood-fired pizza ovens. Oh my God, they did these little pizzas that were just delicious. Tiki bar.
I just can't figure out why. I don't know why that thing didn't work out. I wish I could have bought it myself.
Well, see, Alan, the reason some of that stuff doesn't work out is because of what happens on the front end. I've seen brew pubs like that fail in other places too. They get they get you know, millions of dollars worth of equipment, and they fancy up the facility, and then it is physically impossible to sell enough beer to pay the nut, you know, to keep up with the note. So I think what Chris O'Brien was talking about was really, really valid, and that is, you know, you can get into it relatively cheaply. I mean, you can keg your own homebrew. You can do any number of things. You can keg it. You can bottle it. And for on-premises sale, if you keg your own beer and then serve it out of your tap, like at a small restaurant or something like that, there's almost no overhead, and it's pure profit. Go ahead.
I thought about that plenty of times, of having just a real small brewery, if that would work out. Like, what's the smallest brew pub have you seen? Like, have you seen one with just like two of those big round vats?
Oh, not even that. Not even that, Alan. There are restaurants out there that have just small bucket brewing operations.
Oh, that'd be great.
And like I said, pure profit, either whether you bottle it or whether you keg it. And if you're doing it in a restaurant situation, kegging it is by far and away the smart way to go, because you don't have to sell it for retail or label it or bottle it or anything like that.
Yeah, I knew one of the guys who was like the brewmaster at Magic City Brewery, and I was wanting him to. I wish I could have got a small pub and just got him to make the beer for me. Maybe someday in the future I could figure out something like that.
One thing you can do is, when these things pop up, support them. For instance, I had a note from a musician last fall that was doing a concert in a brew pub in Augusta, Virginia. I would have given anything to be able to have gotten over there for it. But you know, they're popping up all the time.
Uh-huh. I enjoy going by there and having that beer after working outside all day. Like, I used to do groundskeeping for a living.
Yeah.
And then I come by and have one of those beers, like a pale ale, and it just tastes so good at evening after working up a good workout. Really relaxing.
Oh, it is. And, you know, when I was in my brewing days, Alan, you know, you've got to learn to think ahead a little bit. So if you want Christmas beer, you have to be making it in September. And if you want what I used to brew and called lawnmower beer, well, you got to brew your lawnmower beer in January, February. So it'll be ready when you're out, you know, because, you know, when you get off the tractor after a hard day of driving around the yard mowing grass, I'm being a smart aleck, you know, there's nothing like a real beautiful golden wheat beer or something, or, you know, a classic Pilsner or something. And that's the cool thing, Alan. It's available to anybody who wants to do a minimal amount of reading and learning. And if you're into that kind of thing, once you start on the learning curve of this stuff and you write all your recipes down and your specific gravities and what temperature you pitch the yeast at, it's science you can drink. I mean, I remember when our eldest was in fourth grade or so, and she watched me making a batch, and because, you know, you just make it right there in the kitchen. And I got down to the part where I pitched the yeast, and she said, "What is that, Daddy?" And I said, "That's yeast, honey." And she said, "What are yeasts?" And I explained to her the life cycle of the yeast, and boom, science project.
And I always particularly like the beer that they seem to make around October, the October beers.
Oh, the Oktoberfest?
Yeah,
the Oktoberfest beers are actually made back in June, July, because they take. That's what I mean. You have to think ahead. If you want an Oktoberfest beer, you got to be brewing in July, so you can serve in October. If you want a Christmas beer, you've got to be brewing in September, so you can serve in December.
And I developed a taste for the Pilsner too. You like the Pilsner?
Oh gosh, yes. Gosh, yes.
Yeah, that's a good one. And you were talking about Michael Jackson earlier. Some guy named Michael Jackson. You remember a talk show host named Michael Jackson?
Oh, yeah, he's still on the air in L.A. In fact, Mark Levine has been a guest on his show a couple of times.
I remember when I first started listening to the talk radio in the early 80s, he was on the air. Him and Sally Jesse Raphael and Bruce Williams.
The ABC Talk Radio Network, when I was program director of the little bitty AM station in Northwest Alabama, that was our lineup. We had Sally off of NBC Talk Radio, and we had Michael Jackson and a couple of other people off of ABC Talk Radio during the daytime.
Yeah, I liked Michael Jackson. He was liberal, I thought. Back then he was anyway, so like.
Oh, he still is, but he's just so very polite and erudite and you know, quick-witted, but in such a way that one can be cut to pieces by Michael Jackson without ever realizing that the knife has gone in.
And Sally Jesse Raphael, when she went to TV, I think she lost me. She wasn't so interesting after then.
Well, I don't know whatever happened to the reel. When you're in radio, you keep a reel of your old stuff, but one of mine disappeared a long time ago. I used to have promo reels of these people saying, you know, tune in for Bob Kincaid in the afternoons at blah, 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 blah. You know, hello, I'm Michael Jackson. You want to hear Bob Kincaid? Blah, blah, blah.
Hi, I'm Sally Jesse Raphael. Problems. Everybody's got them.
And, because they do this for their affiliates. Oh, I remember. I'd love to find that stuff. It'd be like opening a time capsule, Alan.
And Bruce Williams is pretty good when it comes to, like, everyday finance stuff.
Right, right.
I absolutely didn't like his politics.
No, but I learned more about mutual funds listening to him than just about anybody else, and front loads and no loads and all of that stuff. It was quite fascinating. Yeah. Well, see, and you're pointing out something that's very telling about the evolution of talk radio, Alan, and that is this: talk radio used to be an invitation within the commercial format to a legitimate conversation. It was questions about mutual funds, or it was, my daughter won't clean up her room. What do I do about it? Or it was, I remember when the guy, the author of Dress for Success, used to have a weekly radio show. Loved listening to that because it spoke, Alan, to my desire to have a broad spectrum of information. And that all disappeared with the rise of Rush Limbaugh. With the rise of Rush Limbaugh, the only thing that was worth having on the air was unmitigated hate. And that was the beginning of right-wing domination of radio. I'm sorry, I'm filibustering. I apologize.
You could say that can also be Clear Channel's motivation, too, of their corporate strategy.
Well, exactly.
So they know what they want before they come on the air. They know how they want their program to be. Contrasted to you, who would listen to the callers.
Well, that's what I want. That's what I wanted the horn to be all about. I wasn't. I remember the night that the idea of conversation radio came to me. I was here in the studio. And I'd been out on the road or something listening to talk radio, and I was just disgusted with what I heard. And I said, why can't people just have a conversation? And then it went bing, conversation radio.
Uh-huh. And but you did have knowledge though, didn't you?
Pardon?
You had some brushing up for this kind of work when you went to college.
I've thought about that a lot, Alan. I don't know that college did anything for this. Reading did a lot for this. And you don't have to go to college to read. The things that contribute to this are a desire to learn stuff, a desire to consume information, a desire to share information, a real, real love for people. Ted Kaczynski could never be on talk radio because he didn't like people. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
There's certainly no educational requirement. Rush Limbaugh proves that. Sean Hannity proves that. Most of the right-wing talkers probably have less education than anybody listening to these programs do. But most of the folks listening to these programs either have self-educated themselves or, you know, have paid attention in one form or another. You know, so I don't think it's necessarily a job requirement, but I just went up and down the road for a long time in my life when I was out of radio, Alan, and I kept listening to these blathering yammer heads thinking, you know, Jesus, why won't somebody please give the other side of the issue on this? And I finally got tired of it and decided that, you know, if nobody else would, I would try.
It seemed like to really hear the other side of the issues, you got to get away from the corporate media. And a lot of people do not know how to do that. They don't know how to use a computer, I don't think.
But that's the beauty of it. That means, that, you know, we're talking to a much younger demographic. We're talking to people who are nowhere near the Rush Limbaugh audience, with no disrespect to older folks, is almost entirely older folks. And it's not growing. It's actually demographically shrinking.
Oh, where, that's a good point there, yeah. Because I talked to my sister last night. She's older than I am, and she's one of those who believes that, you know, whatever's on NBC or Fox, that's the truth. So she was trying to tell me that our economy is caused by people here are lazy.
Jesus. What are you going to do? What do you do with that, Alan? What do you do with that?
I tell them, and I keep telling them, that they won't listen to me. I said, it's our trade policy. But then they go back to Fox News, and they keep listening to those talking heads who keep full of a bunch of lies. I guess our hope is for the younger generation, like you're saying.
Yeah. You know, the I mean, kids as young as my own already have an idea that they can get information when they want information. And the old paradigm of, no, by golly, you're going to be here at 7 o'clock and you're going to tune in and you're going to... And the teenagers and 20-somethings and 30-somethings just go, nah, no, we're not. We'll catch it on a podcast.
Uh-huh.
And I personally think that's beautiful.
I do, too. I like the younger generation there.
Well, it scares the daylights out of the mainstream media people, Alan, because their whole existence is based on thou shalt pick up a hard copy newspaper, or thou shalt buy a magazine from a newsstand, or thou shalt tune in at this time to hear this program. And that's not going to be the world of tomorrow.
And you probably, when you were growing up, you probably just like I was, that you just searched anywhere you could other than corporate media to find out what's going on.
Yeah, and that was a challenge because before the Internet, that meant, you know, reading as many magazines, as many newspapers as you could get your hands on, trying to read alternative stuff, trying to read different spins on things. It's all so much easier now, really. I mean, and there's kind of a contradiction in terms in that, because while the information is out there, you have to know how to find it. But it beats the dickens out of sitting in a public library and filling out a request form for something you may get in 2 weeks.
Yeah, now you get in 2 seconds.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I remember, I remember when we got our first public radio station. Wow, I love that.
Oh, yeah. That was a significant moment, sitting in a dorm room in college up in Morgantown and turning on the radio and going, wow, this is cool. And the stuff that I was exposed to, working at the campus radio station up in Morgantown. It's what the Grateful Dead say. What a long, strange trip it's been.
We gotta get out of the box. Can't just sit in front of a TV set. You gotta dig for news, for truth.
Well, you gotta want it.
You gotta want it. That's right.
Well, Alan, how far are you from Birmingham?
Let's see. I could find it. I could tell you exactly. I'm going to back roads. Oh. 224 miles.
Well, cool. I tell you what, when you get there, run by Milo's and have a burger and think of me, would you?
What about Dreamland Barbecue?
Well, Dreamland Barbecue works fine too.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But I have never found a burger like Milo's anywhere in the country. You know, with that brown gravy and those grilled onions. Whoa.
I haven't had one in a while. I have to do that then.
Yeah.
I went to that place in Missouri that you're telling me to go to.
Oh, did you go to Gasper's?
Yeah, but I hate to tell you, it's not there anymore.
Son of a...
They said somebody ruined it. It's kind of like that brew pub we were talking about. Somebody else took over, and they couldn't operate it from out of town, out of towners, and now it's like a fast food restaurant.
I'll be darned. You know, I've been... I don't know if we're going to be able to pull it off yet because I don't know if we'll have the funds to do it, but I'm thinking a lot about the drive across the country to set up for the convention in Denver. And, you know, one of the things I had in mind was I was going to stop for me some gravy, some biscuits and gravy at Gasper's, and that's gone. Daggummit.
Yeah, they said it was a good place.
Oh, it was. I have never had finer biscuits and gravy in my life than 2 o'clock in the morning at Gasper's at the Kingdom City exit of I-70 in Callaway County, Missouri.
Probably had the same cook there for years.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, she probably passed away, and then everything went to hell anyhow. Doggone it, though. Well, at least we still know there's Milo's in Dreamland.
That's right. Dreamland's pretty good.
Yeah, Dreamland's mighty good. Alan, you take care.
All right, thank you.
Yes,
have
indeed. You drive careful now. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
224 miles from home. Keep the shiny side up, Alan. Now, see, guys, if you're on hold, I'm sorry. You know, you got to hang out. If you want to call back, that's cool. But this is, I hope in that conversation you get a sense, and I'm not just beating the drum for the sake of beating the drum. We are honestly trying to do something real here. We're trying to make this as reality-based an experience as it's possible to have, given the separation that exists over the miles upon miles upon thousands upon millions of miles of wire and cable and time and distance. Trying to make it something different. Something to cut into that distance. Something to cut into the frustration. You know, I said when I was done with that wonderful conversation with Chris O'Brien, oh, I hate to go back into the swamp. But you know what? We're all in the swamp. We are all in the swamp. And if we don't look out for each other in here, the snake's going to get us. So as long as you want to have the conversation, we will. I got to tell you, just to be brutally honest, after saying on Monday that you guys had done a wonderful job, and you did, of helping us meet, you know, get a quarter of the way to the April goal, by Sunday, no less, it's like I cursed us, because everything went, and, you know, next to nothing. From then on, very little. But, you know, I still have hopes that April 15th will get here and we'll be at $1,000, and by the time April 30th gets here, we'll be at 2,000 at the very least, so that we can keep running to stand still. If you have a hard time finding the mailing address and you want to participate in keeping the horn on the air, I'll go ahead and announce it now as well. 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. That's if you want to do the snail mail thing. We've got a PayPal button right there at headonradionetwork.com. You can subscribe or you can do a one-time contribution, whatever, however you prefer to, as much or as little. Just please know that we so intensely appreciate everything you guys do to keep this conversation going. Looking around at some other things, some other matters that are of passing import, or at least deserve mention. I had no idea. Well, you know, we don't have any idea, just because the coverage is so pathetic. Colonel Stephen Scott. Here's a guy worth remembering. 54 years old. And he was a runner. He was a member of the Huntsville, Alabama Track Club. He was a marathoner. When he was somewhere where he could do it, he would put in 5-10 miles every day. I admire those guys. Just running never spoke to me. But he loved running, ran marathons. And he got deployed to Iraq, Colonel Scott. Stephen Scott. And this time through, he was put in charge of training and arming Iraqi troops. And he was billeted in the embassy complex, that $700 million... It is million, isn't it? The billions and the millions all have a way of running together for me. It seems like there's just an open faucet in Iraq that just pours out our blood and our treasure. But he was billeted in the green zone in the embassy there. And he got killed last weekend. He was taking a little downtime to hit the treadmill in the exercise room of the embassy when a mortar landed and killed him and a couple of other soldiers. Does that give you an idea of where we are in Iraq? Never mind the platitudes and the stupid little graphs and the color glossy, color 8x10 color glossy photographs with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one that Ryan Crocker and Dave Petraeus the pranced around Congress showing off the other day. That was all phony baloney carnival BS. The reality is that a 54-year-old bird colonel on a treadmill in the green zone, inside the multi-gajillion-dollar embassy complex, got knocked out by something as prosaic as a mortar. So, for the record, let's get this straight. Basra is a mess. Mosul is a mess. Nineveh is a mess. Baghdad is a mess. Inside Baghdad... Oh, wait a minute, we forgot Najaf, and we forgot Fallujah. They're both a mess. And inside the green zone, we can't even build an embassy complex that can protect a colonel on a treadmill in the heart of the building. Mama. Does that tell you what it tells me? He leaves behind two lovely young daughters, 25-year-old Rachel and 22-year-old Rebecca. His funeral, as of the writing of this story, had not been dated yet, but his funeral is scheduled for St. Charles, Missouri, buried in Jefferson Barracks. Nothing in here about whether the Fred Phelps freaks plan to show up. But Lord, I mean, honest to Pete, it's one thing to get killed on the battlefield or wiped out by an IED. All the losses that our military suffers in Iraq are intolerable losses. I don't care how many times George Bush says stuff like, "If you want to make an omelet, you're going to have to break some kernels." That's just bull. But when a guy is on his downtime and is doing some time on a treadmill because he can't go running outside in the green zone, because even that, okay, well, maybe I'll be safe on the treadmill in the gym. When even that is deadly, you know what? You've lost. I don't care how many times Dave Petraeus says that, well, you know, if we just keep from bringing the soldiers home, you know, if we just don't, you know, and surge the surge a little bit more, because we're surging some mighty fine surge. I don't care how many times he says that. If you can't protect a colonel on a treadmill in an embassy complex that has cost the people of this country more money than it would take to clean up, say, Hancock County, Mississippi, from Katrina. If you can't do that, it's time to start thinking about going home, because, baby, you have lost. It's over. You've lost. Speaking of the green zone, however, remember we were talking about right-wing fundamentalist, you know, upstanding, God-fearing, Representative Patrick McHenry, the ripig licking from North Carolina, the guy who called the guard on duty and in front of the gym there in one of Saddam's palaces, called him a two-bit security guard. Well, he's in the hot water again because he told a bunch of lies. When I was in the green zone. There was a rocket attack and people were killed. Pentagon came out and said, no, they weren't. Nobody died in that attack. So to show what a tough, manly man, manly congressman he is, he put out home video that he shot. You know, sort of as a way, look what danger I was in. I'm so virile, I can use a handy cam to take pictures of people. March 22nd, he was in the green zone and he shot video of what was going on there, and the Pentagon has had to tell him to stop it. Why? Well, because this upstanding, troop-supporting, man-of-God, right-wing, repig-licking, according to the Pentagon, is breaching operational security in detailing enemy rocket attacks. Yeah, see, I get conflicted over this story. Because on the one hand, I think, well, yeah, the Pentagon doesn't want any video of rocket attacks inside the much vaunted, you know, it's the only safe place in Iraq, the Green Zone. Well, it ain't safe anymore. Ask Colonel Scott. On the one hand, the Pentagon doesn't need that kind of stuff out there, right? But on the other hand, if anybody's going to screw up and put soldiers who are already in harm's way in greater harm's way, don't you figure it's going to be a chicken hawk or pig licking? What the his spokesman is saying is, the congressman shot the video in the company of State Department and military personnel and was not briefed on withholding its publication. We voluntarily removed the video after learning that it might infringe on accepted protocol and then contacted officials at the Department of Defense who supported our decision. So in other words, the DOD didn't tell him to pull it down. They did it voluntarily, and the DOD said, good on ya! Well, someone here is clearly lying. It shows McHenry, the video does, gesturing to a building behind him and saying that one of 11 rockets hit just over my head. And then he names two other places that were hit by rockets. VoteVets.org accused him of giving away intelligence information that could have aided terrorist organizations in targeting the Green Zone. Brandon Friedman is vice chairman of VoteVets.org. He said the bottom line is that whoever launched that strike could take the information McHenry provided and use it to kill Americans in the Green Zone. This is why professionals operating in a combat zone are trained not to reveal any battle damage after an attack. This all happened March 22nd. Colonel Scott. Colonel Scott was killed in Iraq. Looking here. And they don't give the date. The story doesn't give the date of his death. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? So maybe, just maybe, Congressman McHenry helped kill Colonel Scott with his little self-promotion stunt. But it's not just Colonel Scott. There will be more. If you remember about 5 or 6 months ago, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that he hoped there would only be about 100,000 U.S. troops in Iraq by the time the next president takes office. Well, so much for hope. Hope in one hand and in the other, and see which one fills up first. He was a bit of a smartass today with Senator Carl Levin. You want to see what I mean, or hear what I mean?
The question I'm asking you, though, is are you aware of the fact that General Petraeus refused to use the term brief or pause, and he refused to use any idea of a time period for that second period that began in September? You're aware of the fact of his refusal?
Well, one of the benefits of being Secretary of Defense, I suppose, is that I'm more allowed to hope than the field commander is.
I wish you could see this. You can if you want to. Go over to thinkprogress.org. When he says one of the benefits of being the Secretary of Defense is that I'm allowed to hope more than a field commander is, he sits there and smirks at Carl Levin like a fox eating poop out of a wire brush. The troops in the field to these godless, soulless, motherless repiglicans are nothing. They're not even numbers. They're, you know, if it was a toy, you'd take care of a toy. They're not even toys. They're trash to be wasted by these repiglicans. They're not even worth considering. They're not even worth taking a congressional hearing about them seriously. I get to hope more than field commanders. Let's go back.
Well, one of the benefits of being Secretary of Defense, I suppose, is that I'm more allowed to hope than the field commander is.
Well, I hope that you're doing more than hoping. I hope you're given a hard-headed assessment of what you are recommending to the president.
Well, what I've just described to you, Mr. Chairman, is what I've recommended to the president, and I believe it is consistent with the decisions the president has made.
Other question I want to ask you has to do talking about hope. You said in September of 2007 you hoped that we could get down to 100,000 troops in Iraq by January of 2009. Do you still have that hope?
No, sir.
Why does he hate the troops? Why do these SOB conservatives hate the troops? Do you have any idea how many thousands of hopes he dashed today? Talking about hope, you hoped that we could get down to 100,000 troops in Iraq by January of 2009. Do you still have that hope? No, sir. In other words, I was lying to you all along. And y'all let me. Y'all ain't got enough guts to impeach my boss. Suckers. Brother. Oh, speaking of hope. Speaking of hope, there's a survey out there. It's taken every year. It's been taken every year for the last 18 years. It's taken by the Employee Benefit Research Institute. And the Employee Benefit Research Institute has just released its latest findings. This is one of those get-under-the-table moments, you know, just sort of curl up in a fetal ball in the corner and suck your thumb for a while, you know, just if it makes you feel better. Huh. The percentage of workers who say that they're very confident about having enough money for retirement decreased from 27% last year to 18% this year. Holy cats! Only 27% of working America thinks that they have enough money to retire on. That means that 73% of America is expecting to work until they damned well drop dead. That's a 9 percentage point drop. It turns out it's the biggest one-year drop since the Employee Benefit Research Institute started doing the survey, again, 18 years ago. 34% of those surveyed said that they expect to have access to employer-paid health insurance in retirement. That's down from 42% last year. Wonder why. Could it have anything at all to do with the Supreme Court decision of a couple of weeks ago that told employers it was perfectly all right for them to cut their retirees off from the company health plan once they got old enough for Medicare? Could that have a little something to do with it? Yeah, that could have a little something to do with it. Imagine that. 73% of America expects to John Henry it all the way to the grave. No golden years. No retirement. No dignity. Saying, yes, boss, all the way till the day that they breathe out and don't breathe in again. I tell you, Bob, it's the greatest country in the world. I wish I could hear me that Lee Greenwood song right now. And I'm proud. Remember how I said, I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I was free. More and more, we are fast approaching that Kris Kristofferson place where freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. There's a whole bunch of us mighty free now. Free of retirement, free of fair wages, free of health care, free of savings. After the, you know, the subprime collapse, free of housing. We are the freest country in the world. Whew. I don't know what happens if we get any freer. I don't know if we want to find out. Wow. Just wow. One little note on the way out. Saw it bandied about in the chat room. For those of you who are following this Kabuki Theater, and this also over at Think Progress, just reading it straight off the page. Headline, Randy Rhoads to reportedly move to Clear Channel. According to an email received by Hot Air, Rhoads is about to sign a deal to broadcast on Clear Channel. She's going to be signing a deal with Nova M Radio in the next few hours for about the same money Air America was paying her. She will broadcast Monday afternoon on all Clear Channel affiliates and several other stations. Told you she'd land on her feet, didn't I? Yay, Clear Channel. So, what an interesting night this turned out to be. I gotta get back to... See, it's just so complicated having guests on because there's phone mix-ups and stuff. You know, we'll probably do a little bit more in the way of guests when Agnes comes back to play with us when school lets out. See, Agnes gets free when school lets out. And, you know, we'll try to get some more interesting folks like Chris O'Brien on the program. Thanks for your participation. Thanks for your emails, your phone calls, even those of you who didn't stay on hold long enough to get on the air. Remember, if you're new to the program, what we do here is called Conversation Radio. And we are listener supported. We're at about $600 for the month of April so far in our monthly fundraising, heading toward a contribution goal of $2,000. If you can help, please do so. Many thanks to our IT professional, Peter Godbold, and our chief engineer, John Fox. Thanks to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, at WhiteRoseSociety.org. He's fundraising too. If you value what happens on the horn, you certainly value what happens at whiterosesociety.org. He maintains all of our streams and all of our podcasts and doesn't know the meaning of taking a break. Thanks to my brave, courageous friends at Coal River Mountain Watch who bring you, in part, the daily broadcast from the Head On Radio Network. You can realize that you're all, no matter where you are, downstream and do something about it and help us end mountaintop removal by going to crmw.net and joining. It costs very little. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Kids, it's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 104 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Friday, January the 18th, 2008, so if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m., on a Friday, that is January the 18th, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to call in and talk to myself and to the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. If you have an unlimited long-distance calling plan, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel.